This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for Tuesday, December 13th.
Markets are pricing in a 100% chance of a rate hike tomorrow. Former Philadelphia Fed President Charles Plosser previews tomorrow's decision by the Federal Reserve.
This will be a non-event. They're going to raise rates. In fact, the biggest scare for me or biggest worry I have is that they don't do anything about rate hikes tomorrow. That would be the worst outcome.
Plus, oil prices have been on the rise, but tycoon T. Boone Pickens sees crude prices heading even higher.
The producers of oil, whether it be OPEC, the Russians, whether it's the oil and gas industry in the United States, have all had enough.
And we bring you a conversation with Royal Bank of Scotland Chairman Howard Davies.
The core business of RBS is doing well. We are growing share in mortgages. We are growing share in business lending.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. Are your returns dragged down by high transaction costs? Trade up to Interactive Brokers, where our lower costs can help you maximize your returns. Visit ibkr.com/savemore for more information.
The Federal Reserve is in the midst of its final interest rate meeting of the year, and the first since Donald Trump's election victory. Fed fund futures indicate a 100% chance the Fed will raise rates tomorrow. Former Philadelphia Fed President Charles Plosser talked earlier with Jonathan Farrow, Lisa Abramowitz, and Michael McKee.
Do you think if the Fed does raise rates, as they're widely expected to do, and continues on the trajectory next year, that we are going to see asset bubbles unwind that could be potentially damaging?
Well, I don't think we know where asset bubbles are, for one thing. So it's hard to actually tell. But I do think that what's become very clear now is that the Fed, with this rise in markets, we have to understand that the Fed doesn't control rates the way we sometimes think they do. And so the Fed is now in a rush, or not in a rush, but will be under pressure to raise rates more than they might otherwise have because they're falling behind the curve. And this is something I don't think that the committee wanted to have happen, but it was the danger of waiting and not gradually moving up and now having potentially the risk of having to chase them up. I think that's a real challenge for them.
Here's a question. Obviously, the Fed doesn't know what's going to come out of Washington.
Right.
Another reason for them to wait. But if you're going to stimulate the economy at a time when you're very close to full employment, you run the risk of accelerating inflation. Can the Fed stay ahead of the curve on that, or do they run the risk of falling behind if massive stimulus comes into an economy that's already running very close to or above potential?
Well, I think they don't know what's going to happen, what the bills are going to look like. I think it's very challenging for them to try to figure that out. Will the stimulus, or not stimulus, will the fiscal actions be actually traditional demand-side Keynesian stimulus? Or is it going to focus on productivity gains, which I think is the real problem? We don't really need a lot of demand stimulus right now. That's not the economy's problem. And so I think it's going to depend a lot on sort of what actually ends up coming out of Congress.
Would you warn the markets that the yield curve could get a lot steeper very, very quickly?
Yes. Whether that will or not, I don't know. But certainly that's more of a risk now than even it was, you know, 6 months or a year ago.
So, Charles, you know, one thing that you had talked about was that you had expected inflation to pick up much more than the Fed was expecting. Now, all of a sudden, we are actually seeing inflation expectations pick up. It didn't happen for so long. Why is it happening now?
Well, there are probably as many stories about that as there are people trying to answer that question. They're all different. And I think it's hard to know. And I think it's partly what matters here is that the Fed doesn't always know. And our forecasts are difficult. The Fed underestimated economic growth for a long time, partly because there was no mechanism in their models which allowed for the massive regulatory state that sort of has evolved over the last 10 years and what that was going to do to the economy. They didn't forecast, nor does anybody else, forecast productivity growth very well. So I think there are a lot of things we just don't know. I think the story on inflation is really not is not settled yet. The jury is still out. We may have a lot of inflation yet, and the question is going to be, can the Fed, during this process of unwinding its large balance sheet, control it as effectively as they think they can?
Yesterday, Bob Michael, J.P. Morgan Asset Management Chief Investment Officer, said on Bloomberg Radio that he thinks that the Fed should not make this meeting a non-event, which a lot of people are expecting it to be. He said they should telegraph 4 rate hikes next year. Do you agree?
I guess I wouldn't quite put it that way. This will be a non-event. They're going to raise rates. In fact, the biggest scare for me or biggest worry I have is that they don't do anything about rate hikes tomorrow. That would be the worst outcome. I don't think the Fed knows how many rate hikes it's going to take next year. I mean, we're already, even if they raise tomorrow, you're at 75 basis points or 50 to 75 basis points. That's still a full percentage point below the rate of inflation.
John and I were talking in the last hour about how Donald Trump has sort of taken both sides of the issue on Janet Yellen and the Fed at one point during the campaign, tweeting out that the Fed should have raised interest rates earlier, and now maybe saying that Yellen he can work with. If you were to sit down with him, what would you tell him about the Fed?
I would probably tell him a couple of things. One is, be careful. The Fed is an important institution. It is incredibly important that its independence be preserved, and both as in reality as well as the perception of that independence. And so I would say respect its independence. Appoint good people to the board, let them do their work.
That was former Philadelphia Fed President Charles Plosser speaking earlier on Bloomberg Daybreak.
Coming up, we'll talk the health of the Italian banking industry with David Harrow of Harris & Associates.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Bentley University. What do rebooting America's oldest ski shop and crunching numbers at Vistaprint have in common? An MBA from Bentley University that prepares graduates to innovate and lead, because business is everywhere. Prepare here.
UniCredit plans to raise $13.8 billion in a rights offer in an effort to boost profit. David Harrow, Chief Investment Officer of Harris & Associates, talked with Tom Keene and David Gura on Bloomberg Surveillance.
The UniCredit news is good because it shows that some proactivity is finally occurring in Italy. It is their biggest bank. We do have an Italian bank, but our Italian bank doesn't have any of the issues that UniCredit has. UniCredit has been selling some assets, which is good. They're raising capital, which is good. They're really fortifying themselves. And if they could get this Montepaschi di Siena situation fixed and get the NPL situation fixed, they'll be on their way. But our view was a lot of these European banking shares were just selling at too low of prices. They were overly reflecting the bad news that's in Europe and not reflecting some of the positive things that were happening. And so we thought it was an opportunity. And it took a while for the shares to perk up, but they're finally doing so now.
What are some of those positive things that are happening in Europe?
Well, yeah, first of all, you have the plateau of slowing growth. Growth seems to be picking up a little bit. Second of all, you have loan losses have actually declined pretty much across Europe, and it's been kind of a source of profit in a way, because you're just seeing higher quality credit than what you have seen in Europe. You're actually seeing some credit growth in the low single digits, and you're seeing banks proactively cut fees. So at the beginning of the year, when everyone was fearing that these low negative rates would smash earnings of banks, we haven't seen bank earnings be smashed. In fact, we've seen some stability or slow growth.
Right. Hey, David, I gotta make some money back because I keep losing and betting against the Packers. David Harrow, should I be acquiring European bank shares this morning?
Yeah, I think there's certain certain banks. Again, as you know, Tom, we're really stock selective, company selective. And I think certain of the high-quality banks that are still selling at attractive valuations, BNP Paribas, Intesa Sanpaolo, Lloyds, Credit Suisse, these are things which still offer very, very good value. All for their each individual company has its own reasons, really, but they're selling at low prices. And I believe almost in every one of those cases I mentioned, you're going to continue to see earnings growth.
Can you attribute the political stability that we're seeing? I mean, looking back at that referendum, and it seems now that you do have Italy, as you say, taking a more proactive approach here to these banks. Can you attribute that to the referendum? And we got the news yesterday that Pier Carlo Padoan will stay on as the finance minister in that country. Are you convinced we're going to have a stable enough environment there to get these reforms done here in the near to medium term?
Well, I think there's just really a strong motivation to get these reforms done. And one of the most important things is and these NPLs is the collateral and enabling the creditors to make a call on the collateral. In Italy, this process takes 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years. And everywhere else in the world, it takes 1 or 2 years. And that puts that causes those NPLs to be worth a lower price. Maybe 20, 25 cents on the dollar versus 30 or 40. And they're working on this. This is known. This is a known issue that they have to accelerate the resolution process in Italy. And this step alone would be very meaningful because it would almost increase the price of these NPLs, the ones that are selling at 20 cents on the dollar to 30, 35, in some cases 40 cents on the dollar. And there is a ready market for it. You see various financial firms in there buying these NPLs.
We know that the banking sector is so overbanked in Italy. How do you position yourself, given there's likely to be some mergers here in the near term?
Yeah, this is one of the bits of good news. Spain did this a couple of years ago very successfully, and they basically told all these co-op banks, the game is over. You have to be a for-profit entity, and if you can't make money and raise capital, you're out of business or you're merging with someone else. Now, finally, they're doing this in Italy. Germany also needs for this to happen. The Landesbanken, these are these regional banks that are kind of state-owned entities that just don't exist to make profits. So they're lax on credit. They give too much interest, and they're non-economic, hurting the companies like Deutsche Bank, which can't compete. Well, Italy is actually ahead of Germany in trying to get these co-op banks merged and capped up.
That was David Harrow of Harrison Associates speaking with Tom Keene and David Gura on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Coming up, oil tycoon T. Boone Pickens on where the price of oil is headed and his reaction to ExxonMobil's Rex Tillerson being nominated as Secretary of State.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on oil prices, how they are set, and where they might be going with Bloomberg's Brian Wingfield.
The situation.
Well, it's a proxy for a lot of things because everybody needs it. It's been used as a weapon in the past. But it can also be a blessing if your economy is flush with oil and your prices are rising, or it can be a curse if your economy is dependent on oil and prices are falling.
The background.
It used to be that cartels or cartel-like groups controlled the market. In the middle of the 20th century, you had oil majors like the Seven Sisters. And then back in the 1960s and 70s, OPEC became more prominent, their group of oil-rich nations. More recently, the market is controlled simply by supply and demand, prices being set through exchanges and things like that.
The argument.
Well, everybody needs energy, so you want it to be abundant. The debate is over where the energy comes from. The world relies on fossil fuels, and burning those fuels triggers emissions that are linked to climate change, which is a huge problem for the entire planet. So we have to find a way to balance the demand for energy and the byproducts that it causes.
For more on oil prices or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter. Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Norton from Symantec. To help protect you in a changing digital world, Norton plans to join forces with LifeLock. When combined, they will redefine digital safety and help you gain control of your privacy, security, and identity.
T. Boone Pickens is a giant in the oil field. The oil tycoon is the chairman and CEO of BP Capital. Scarlett Fu and Joe Weisenthal asked Pickens about the recent OPEC deal and his thoughts on ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson being nominated for Secretary of State.
I can't emphasize this more. When Tillerson leaves Exxon and goes with the State Department, he is 100% State Department. Exxon's got plenty of people to run Exxon. They don't need another CEO. They've got a CEO in waiting. So he will go to all lengths to be the very best Secretary of State the United States has ever had.
Is Darren Woods, the president of ExxonMobil, the CEO in waiting, the one who would then succeed Rex Tillerson?
I don't know who's going to succeed Tillerson. I know this. Don't worry about Exxon. They've got plenty of executives, qualified, good CEOs that are available there, and no question about it. And so. The day he leaves and goes to work for the State Department, he will be 100% for the government. He's not working for Exxon anymore.
How confident are you that OPEC will be able to execute on what it's announced? Do you think they'll be able to go for a while without cheating and boost the price of oil from here?
No, I'm long oil, so I think it's they want more for their oil, and they have said what they're going to do, and they will carry out what they say they'll do. They will cut supply, and the price of oil will come up. I mean, it's the producers of oil, whether they be OPEC, the Russians, whether it's the oil and gas industry in the United States, have all had enough, and so you will be at $60 a barrel within 30 days.
$60 a barrel in 30 days, that's your forecast, as long as OPEC abides by the production cuts that they've agreed to?
Yes. I think that you will have those cuts, and you will see January of next year, you'll be up $60 a barrel.
What about much higher than that? I mean, I feel like we've completely discounted the ideas that we're going to see, say, triple-digit oil per dollars per barrel anytime soon. Is it plausible that we could get back there? What do you see for 2017, 2018, and beyond?
Okay, take me up to 2018. You got a chance, but you aren't gonna have $100 oil in 2017. But I do think you can have $75 oil in 2017.
But there have been a lot of instances where OPEC hasn't been able to comply with production cuts that they have set out in the past. Do you expect there to be wobbles along the way, instances where they can't quite commit to what they have promised? What might those look like?
Well, you're saying that they won't stick with the deal.
Correct.
I believe they will stick with the deal. I think it's going to happen. And when you look, I mean, the Russians need money. OPEC needs money. I think they will stick with the deal. The Saudis have said they will cut below 10 million a day. So they're cutting out a million barrels a day. So they have to be the biggest one to do it. When they perform, when they show the leadership, and they will, that the other countries will come along.
That was T. Boone Pickens speaking with Scarlett Fu and Joe Weisenthal.
And coming up, we're talking about the health of the banking industry and regulation with Royal Bank of Scotland Group Chairman Howard Davies.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
with the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report. I'm Charlie Pellett. As the 2017 NFL schedule firms up, look for more games coming from London. Four games will be played there as the NFL continues to grow internationally. Two of the games will be played at Wembley Stadium. The other two will be played at Twickenham. The Jaguars will host the Ravens, marking their first appearance, and the Browns will host the Vikings. Also playing in London, the Saints and the Dolphins. We'll learn more about specific game dates next spring when the NFL releases its full schedule. The NFL's history in London goes back to 2007. Well, the First Lady is weighing in on the world of sport, specifically outdoor sports. She says skiing does for her what golf does for the president. Michelle Obama says it is great exercise, it's fun, and a little scary, too. With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Charlie Pellett.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by National Realty, managers of New York City cash flow real estate, providing you 12% annualized returns with immediate monthly distributions. See them at nria.net.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. In March 1955, the U.S. unemployment rate was 4.6%. This November, it was also 4.6%. Does that mean today's labor market is as healthy as that of 1955? No. In March 1955, 97.4% of American men aged 25 through 54, what's called prime age, either had a job or were looking for one. This November, that percentage was down to 88.5%. That means about 9% of prime-age American men have gone missing from the labor force since 1955. And because they're not in the labor force, they don't show up in the unemployment rate, which only counts people who are actively looking for jobs. For women, the story is different. There were big gains in female labor force participation from the 1950s through the 1990s. Still, since 2000, women's labor force participation has fallen too. This rise in the number of labor force dropouts has led some to criticize the unemployment rate as misleading. These critiques can be overdone, such as Donald Trump's frequently voiced claim that the true unemployment rate is above 40%. But the official unemployment rate really is missing something. I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thank you, Justin. Howard Davies is the chairman of the Royal Bank of Scotland Group. In a wide-ranging interview with Francine Lacroix, Tom Keane, he spoke about the health of the banking industry, Brexit, and regulation under the Trump administration.
When you look at Fed expectations, when you look at, you know, what the banks are going through, what is the biggest risk to 2017? Is it monetary policy doesn't deliver, or is that there's a kind of a crunch time in the banking sector?
I think that at the moment, the way monetary policy is evolving is on the whole quite sensible and quite beneficial. The president-elect's policy of making inflation great again is sort of working. And I think that we're in a gentle tightening phase, even the ECB reducing the amount of QE somewhat. And I think on the whole, that's quite good from a banking perspective because the yield curve is rising. And unless you have a positive sloping yield curve, banking is kind of a difficult business. I think the worries are more elsewhere. I think the worries still are in Chinese credit growth. I was in Beijing last week, and undoubtedly things are still moving forward. I mean, there is growth in the economy, but it's coming at the expense of a very large expansion of credit. And that, I think, is something we've all got to keep an eye on. And, of course, we have to keep an eye on Italy, though the news is slightly better today.
On China, what's your biggest concern? Actually, what's the solution? So you have this trinity or trilemma, whatever you want to call it, which is renminbi going down, outflows accelerating, and reserves also going down. How do you fix this?
Well, I think the Chinese at the moment are applying sticking plaster to it in taking various measures to try to reduce the outflows, you know, whether it's preventing people from using their credit cards in Hong Kong or whatever. There's a lot of rather micro measures going on. But I think in due course, they're going to have to acknowledge that credit is too high and they probably are going to have to raise rates.
overall, Sir Howard, what's your take on Italian banks? I mean, there are healthy banks and not so healthy banks, but sometimes the market confuses them.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's overall in Italy, there is a major problem of non-performing loans. That is dramatically higher than in France, Germany, or certainly in the UK. And that is, that's the fundamental problem. But of course, the different banks do have different business models and they have different incidences of non-performing loans. And also they have different quality of management, I guess. UniCredit, I presume, in going for 13.8 billion, Jean-Pierre Mustier, who is a very experienced and very smart guy, I presume he would not give that size of party unless he thought some guests were going to show up. So I presume he has some reason to believe through his brokers that he's going to get that money. And I think that's good news, because what has been happening in Italy has been the banks have been trying to improve their capital position, but they have been having to do it by reducing the scale of their balance sheet. And the more they rein in lending, the more Italy goes into, slows growth further, the more non-performing loans there are. This is a downward spiral. And you can't really increase the health of your banking system entirely by reducing the size of your balance sheet. You've got to do some of it, sell off some bad loans, sure, but ultimately you have to have a stronger capital base. So the fact that they're going for a big injection of capital, I think, is good news, and I think that's why the share price has responded positively.
I know it's very difficult to actually put ourselves in the shoe. Investors, or I don't know if it's a kind of anchor investors, but is there an interlinkage between Monte Paschi and UniCredit? So if you're an investor, do you say, do I invest in one bank or the other? Or actually, if Monte Paschi cannot, for some reason, raise that capital, does it mean that the capital raising exercise for UniCredit is at risk?
I'm not sure there's an absolutely direct link, but I suppose it's a fair point to say that the market, whatever that is, has a degree of appetite for Italian bank risk, and probably that's limited. People will be looking at their overall portfolios, the big investors, and saying, just how much Italian bank risk do we want? So I guess there is some sense in which this is a zero-sum game, but of course, I think with Monte dei Paschi, it will depend heavily on what price they want.
If you move it to RBS, how would you describe the turnaround? It seems to be painfully slow. And is there any way that RBS should be taken, because the turnaround has been so slow, that should be either taken over completely by our government or actually broken apart or turned into a customer-owned lender?
I have to sort of take apart your initial premise there. The core business of RBS is doing well. We are growing share in mortgages. We are growing share in business lending. And the core business is throwing off roughly £1 billion a quarter in profits. The problem at RBS remains the legacy. The two things hanging over RBS are Williams & Glynn, which is a consequence of this state aid in 2008, and the subprime mortgage problem, which, of course, is the same as Deutsche, Credit Suisse, Barclays. We've all read about them, and we are in that queue. These are things which date way back. The RMBS problem in the States dates back to 2007, has nothing to do with the current management or indeed the previous management. So two managements back.
And that's an absolute...
So the core business, I think, you've got to look at. The core business is doing okay. It's not clear to me that you would do anything to improve that by restructuring the bank now.
And that's an absolutely fair comment. Are you not disappointed by the fact that the government still owns 73%? If you looked at the timeline, would have thought by this point they would have sold shares.
That's true, but the obstacle to that has been the slow resolution of legacy issues, which I'm afraid are not completely, but in the case of the subprime mortgage, completely out of our control.
What do we know about what Donald Trump wants for regulation on Wall Street and the impact it would have on European banks?
Well, we don't know a lot directly, but the ideas that do seem to be of interest to people around the Trump administration are the ones that have been put forward by Jeb Hensarling from the House Financial Services Committee. And essentially, his idea is that if a bank meets a 10% leverage ratio, then a lot of the other requirements, the Volcker rule, the stress testing requirements, the need to put in a huge capital plan each year, would all fall away. That if you are that safe with that little leverage, then you're fine. Now, of course, many US banks don't meet that yet, but on average, they have about 8% or 8.2% leverage. And so some of them are within striking distance of that. And that would be an interesting challenge because it would make regulation a lot simpler, which I think is possibly quite an attractive idea. And it would, of course, make the American banks pretty safe. A 10% leverage ratio is a fairly aggressive capital requirement, but then with a lot of other things behind it. Then, of course, we'd be faced with a position, well, in the UK, then what do you do? Do you decide that maybe you should move in that direction because otherwise UK banks in the US would be facing
a different
competitive environment, and that takes you further away from Europe. So I think if they do move in that direction, it's going to be quite some interesting policy choices in the UK.
Sir Howard, you're briefing the new Secretary of State on Brexit. Give us an update, your view. What have you learned in the last number of weeks on Brexit, and what will you look for in January?
Specifically in relation to financial services, I think what we're seeing, and you hear that from the Chancellor of the Exchequer today, that the government is appreciating that the market does need some degree of reassurance on the transition, and that the notion of a cliff edge where one day you're in and one day you're out is one that's very alarming for financial markets. And I think that the optimist in me says that's starting to be understood, that that is not an issue of questioning whether we leave or not, we are going to leave, but it is about how you do it. And I think if we don't have some assurance in the markets on a transitional arrangement, then next year you're going to see quite a lot of firms preparing for the worst and starting to move people to other centres in Europe, which would be unfortunate from a UK government point of view. So I'm slightly more optimistic in the last week or two than I have been before that the realities of financial markets in relation to Brexit are starting to be understood by policymakers.
That was Royal Bank of Scotland Group Chairman Howard Davies speaking with Francine Lacroix and Tom Keane on Bloomberg Surveillance.
That's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
Our show is produced by David Sutcherman and Richard Truman.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.